Hi, my name is Hans Peter Meyer, and I'm the host of the Men's Work Podcast, where you'll find interviews with men and with women. You'll find yoga classes, you'll find reflections, you'll find a lot of material to hopefully help you move through the tests that life has handed you: end of marriage, loss of job, marital relationship stress, fatherhood, just being overwhelmed. It's a lot. So listen, if you need to talk, I've got no charge mini coaching sessions at menswork.ca. Enjoy the show. Welcome to whoever is here and whoever is listening. This is another edition of the podcast that I host. And today I'm joined by Jay Singh, or Jai Singh. Is it Jay or Jai?
Jay, actually, yeah.
Jay. Jay Singh, and I'm on Vancouver Island, and Jay is halfway around the world on another island in the United Kingdom. So,
US actually, but yeah, some of the men I work with are in the UK as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that's how I know you, is through someone from the UK, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, what part of the US are you from? Are you in?
Yeah, I'm in the state of Virginia, so about two hours south of Washington, D.C.
Okay, so we're a continent apart.
Yes.
And as I was saying to Jay, you know, a lot of what we do as men, well, we're going to be talking about fatherhood today. A lot of what we do as men, or my observation, is that confronted with situations, we immediately go into our heads. And our mind is a beautiful and powerful tool. But it's only one of the tools that we have, and it's actually not a very good tool when it comes to relationships, being a father, being a husband, being a friend. So let's take a moment to just drop into that other really powerful tool, which is our body. So if you're listening to this right now, if you're driving, you can't do this. Sorry. You could try it with your eyes open, but I actually discourage you from doing that. But otherwise, just close your eyes and bring attention to how you're sitting. So if you're slumped in your chair, which is a wonderful place to be, I just want you to right now sit up and feel the weight of your sit bones in the chair that you're in, or on the cushion that you're sitting on. Just feel the bottom of your body heavy. And then just lift your spine out of that pelvis a little bit. Tuck your chin a little bit. So now you've got this straight line basically from the crown of your head to the base of your spine. Start breathing through your nose. That will slow your breath down a little bit. So what I'm going to ask you to do is to breathe in for the count of four, to hold for the count of four, to exhale for the count of four, to hold empty for the count of four, and just do that for the next couple minutes. So when we start to pay attention to our breath and attention to how it moves into our body. So when you're breathing in, let your belly get nice and round. And as you exhale, pull that navel in towards your spine. And now as you exhale and as you hold empty, start to pull up on your anus, your sex organs, your navel. And just hold that. That's called a root lock. And then as you inhale, you relax that root lock. And just let the bottom of your body, basically your perineum, your pelvic floor, let that become nice and soft and heavy as it connects to whatever you're sitting on. So you're creating a slow pulse in your body, one of opening down with this full belly of air. And then as you exhale, it's as if you're drawing up. And imagine that as you draw up and as you exhale and as you hold empty, you're tightening up your spine. You're moving that root lock up your spine and the back of your heart, back of your shoulders, back of your neck, all the way to the crown of your head. And then as you breathe in, you're relaxing that and relaxing into your belly, again, relaxing your pelvic floor, connecting with the floor, the earth below you. And whenever you're faced with some kind of a tense situation or something that wants to move you into the fight, flight, or freeze response, which are very natural responses to any kind of new situation, and it's one of our gifts as men to be really good at defending. So that we often get criticized for being defensive, but it's actually one of the things, one of our gifts, as long as we know how to use it. So right now, this practice I'm giving you right now, just breathing in and relaxing yourself down, and then selectively tensing your body as you move energy up your body. These are ways of responding rather than reacting to situations that might otherwise just trigger a defensive reaction in you. This is especially useful when your partner, if they're the feminine partner in your relationship, if they ask you to sit down or ask you to talk about something, often we immediately go into a defensive posture. So just practice breathing, and your child could possibly trigger the same response, especially if they're teenagers. It's a good practice to know how to respond to situations rather than just react. There are very good times to respond defensively and protectively. A bear is threatening your child. The dog on the street lunges at you. And there's very good times to just relax and hold the space. Child is having a temper tantrum. Your wife is reminding you again of the anniversary that you've forgotten. Your boss is giving you a very tight deadline. Now, on your final inhale, I just want you to hold that for a little bit longer. Feel your body nice and round. And then with an open mouth, just relax the breath. Relax your shoulders. Now you can choose to open your eyes right now, or if you're able to, you can just keep your eyes closed. And Jay and I will start to talk about fatherhood, working with men, being a man, or whatever comes up here. And if you're listening to this on the recorded podcast, you're still invited to send us questions. If you've got questions for Jay, I'll forward them to him. You can respond on the podcast app, or you can send me an email at hans@sacredbodies.ca. Or you can go to my website, sacredbodies.ca, and send me a question there. So first, I just want to say thank you, Jay, for being in touch with me. I hosted a few podcast episodes on specifically on fatherhood, and it's a beautiful topic and a really challenging one for lots of us. So you specifically said you wanted to talk about this and the work that you do. So tell me about what you do. Tell me about why fatherhood is important to you, perhaps as a father and as a man, and perhaps as a coach or as a men's leader.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Hans, and the question. And if it's all right, maybe I'll just start with my own story as a place, because that's kind of what inspired me to do the work that I'm doing right now with men. You know, fatherhood for me as a journey was it was extremely intense, kind of from the beginning, and it stretched me, and it continues to stretch me, continues to humble me in countless ways. But to me, it's just this powerful, I use the word crucible, because I think it has this capability of, or likelihood of, ratcheting up the intensity in our lives to such a degree that it really exposes all of the ways that, at least in my experience, that I was able to hide old childhood wounds and patterns and ways of showing up from myself, even, you know, from my wife. And, you know, in the early days of fatherhood, the sleep deprivation and the big adjustments of going from being able to live a fairly self-centered life, you know, honestly, to, you know, being responsible with my wife, my partner, to take care of our daughter, is just a really big, you know, adjustment, as I think a lot of men go through. And I think our culture generally doesn't do much to prepare us for that. To me, it's kind of an ongoing rite of passage, fatherhood, and it doesn't really, I think, prepare us for just how intense of a journey it can be. And you know, that kind of that mixture of sleep deprivation and complete change to marriage and complete change to how I was able to, you know, take care of myself and nourish myself, and then just getting my buttons pressed by my wife for just having a lot more conflict in our relationship and less time for connection and intimacy and just, you know, conversation period. Having, you know, a new child, it just it really started to just melt me down, and it kind of exposed all of these, you know, ways of showing up, old belief structures that weren't really supportive, but I was able to kind of keep hidden, I feel like, even from myself for a while. And it just kind of, you know, beliefs that I had about myself that weren't true, but that I believed in strongly. It's just all these things came up to the surface and came up in conflict with my wife, or it just came up in moments of just feeling strung out or desperate and looking for something. And at the same time, it was this beautifully powerful way of forcing me to grow in a way that, you know, I knew fatherhood would, you know, bring a lot of growth, but I wasn't prepared for just how intense of the process it would be. And, you know, I think in a lot of ways before becoming a father, I was still kind of operating as a boy in a man's body. You know, I hadn't really done any kind of full-blown initiatory work as a man. I'd certainly done a lot of inner work prior to that, but not really kind of stepping fully into my own manhood, and having to own the role of being a leader in many ways of my family. And, you know, I think a good kind of, you know, masculine archetype to draw parallels with the father is also kind of like a king archetype within the home itself. And it's not that the king is coming about in a kind of dominating, you know, his family or being in charge, and his wife isn't in a role of authority or power herself, but just that there are certain ways of which, you know, being willing to just serve the kingdom as selflessly and courageously as is needed for the well-being of the kingdom, you know, learning how to set boundaries with my own parents about what my new nuclear family needed, and having to like cut these old ties of sitting at the table of my old nuclear family, and having to have really challenging and at times, you know, just kind of painful conversations with my parents about, let's say, not being able to come visit because my wife, or stay with us when they would come visit, because my wife needed more space kind of postpartum, you know, as we were taking care of newborn. And just, it's a lot of new territory. And so for me, it just, that journey of fatherhood and all of its intensity also just brought about these massive, you know, amounts of growth in my life and transformation, and really being able to mature as a man. And I felt in my heart, I think within about maybe 6 months to a year, this a strong desire to be sharing this work with other men, at least in terms of orienting to fatherhood in this way of it being a profoundly transformative journey and process. But I didn't, frankly, I mean, just kind of being so new to fatherhood is kind of just like, I don't know what I'm talking about. Who am I to share anything about this? And I was ultimately, I was just terrified, frankly, of trying to provide any form of kind of structure or leadership in this space. And so for a number of years, I just didn't do anything with that calling in my heart to bring this, other than occasionally have a, you know, really deep conversation with another man who was going through his own kind of journey of transformation. And then I finally got to a place where it was actually, we were living in California until our son was, he was about 9 months old. And then we actually moved to Costa Rica and tried that out. We'd gotten to a place in California where the smoke from the wildfires had just kind of, my wife had reached a breaking point. She couldn't handle the air quality any longer. The long stretches of smoke, even in our home. So we ended up moved down there, had quite an adventure. And then after a while realized that this wasn't a good kind of sustainable foundation for us at that point in our family kind of trajectory, our son being so little. And we ended up moving to Richmond, Virginia, where my wife's family's based. And at that point, or before I left California, I'd started a men's circle for fathers, but it was really, I would say, like, my work really kind of began much more in earnest when I got to Virginia and just started to realize, you know, this is something I can't keep putting off. I can't keep making these excuses for not being able to do it because I don't have the time. I don't have the, you know, kind of bandwidth. My family isn't going to necessarily draw some immediate benefit from this work, but it's just been something that now I feel so strongly dedicated or just called to support other men through this kind of process, this alchemy that fatherhood offers, if they're willing to orient to it as a place of tremendous opportunity for growth and transformation, instead of seeing it as a burden. Ultimately, I think a lot of men relate to fatherhood from a place of feeling burdened. A lot of times they may not necessarily say it or even consciously think that, but you know, the loss of freedom, I think, is one of those core, you know, challenges that the masculine energy kind of wrestles with. And fatherhood certainly can take away some of the freedoms we had prior to it. So
thank you. I mean, lots of what you say resonates for me. How old are you?
I'm 36.
And how old is your son now?
My son is about to turn 3.
Yeah, well, you got lots of great stuff ahead of you.
Yeah.
I was 27 when my first daughter was born. I'm 64 now, so whatever that is, you know, 37 years ago. I was lucky in that I had some older, most of the men that I hung out with were older than me, like quite a lot older than, well, 7 or 8, 9 years older than me, even older. And some of them had kids, so I was pretty aware of what that meant for their lives. And my daughter arriving was really a surprise. I mean, holy shit, you have sex and then all of a sudden somebody's pregnant. Like, how does that happen, right? And really, I didn't even know this woman. Like, you know, we'd been dating for a very short period of time. But I'd been around men and kids enough that I realized, and women, and I realized that I had to make a commitment to this child. Even if I didn't know if I could make this commitment to this woman, I was definitely committed to this child. And like you, I just found that I'm not sure there's any kind of initiation we can do that's as powerful as having a child. Okay. I respect people who choose not to have kids. I mean, that's great. But I think something happens when we, and maybe it happens when our parents get really old and they become really dependent on us. I mean, I've experienced some of that where we, you know, you talked about basically get into a place of, or my interpretation is, you know, there's no room for selfishness, or the selfishness takes on a different quality. And it's about, well, if I actually really want to have a good life, it means I need to attend to somebody else here. So now I get to do that with an aging parent. And my father passed a few years ago. But having a child really, it kind of, in some ways it was a liberation, because it liberated me from the this kind of solipsistic or very selfish or very self-centered kind of struggle for purpose and meaning. You know, all of a sudden there was no question. It was like, you know, it's down to like, you got to make sure there's enough food on the table and that there's a roof over these people's heads, you know, like, this woman is looking after your child. I mean, and we, you know, my partner, who became my first wife eventually, but, you know, she was in graduate school. We were both in graduate school. You know, she had career aspirations. She was also, you know, very clear about just not wanting to be swallowed up by this, you know, being a mom and not falling into some kind of traditional, you know, not doing what her mom had done. And for my part, again, because I had older men friends, I was really clear that I wanted to be like super involved in my kids. Like, I had no hesitation about, like, you know, being 50-50 kind of stuff. Like, that was like the bare minimum. Like, and I didn't really understand what that meant, but I knew that I wanted to be really involved in raising my kids. And as difficult as that marriage was, I really appreciate that my wife, you know, created lots of space for me to make all kinds of mistakes with my kids and to develop all kinds of bonding, you know. And so for any men who are listening, like, I just, as frightened as you may be of looking after a young child or taking full responsibility for kids for a weekend or a week or whatever, like, my relationships with all of my kids, including my two daughters and my two stepsons, you know, it's that's when it happened. And definitely, you know, it was an initiation that I couldn't have imagined, and that I, well, my first wife, so she's pregnant, right? We hardly know each other. She goes to the clinic and then we meet afterwards. We're in the woods going for a walk, and she's telling me that, okay, now it's like, I've been feeling this in my body, and I'm pretty sure that I've been pregnant, but I actually have the test results, and yes, I'm pregnant. And she said she watched the color drain from my face. Like, I just went white in front of her, you know? And then I spent some time just basically trying to avoid that reality. Like, I just, it was super scary. You know, again, I didn't know this woman very well. I was just starting grad school. I had ideas about what I wanted to do, all these things. And I was really, you know, at some level, I was committed to like supporting this child and supporting her and having this child. Yeah, it's a crucible. And, you know, my experience is that in some ways that initial shock to the system of, oh, all of those things that I just took for granted, my freedom, my ability to just do what I wanted to do, pretty much, that's all gone. That's hard. And then, you know, throughout their lives, there's more. And there's more, and every one of those things has asked me to be more in a way that I couldn't have imagined. And it's been great. And some of it's been really hard. You know, one of my kids really struggles with drug-induced mental health issues, you know? And so there's been hard issues around addiction and hospitalization and calling the cops and, you know, setting some hard boundaries and watching him struggle. And figuring out how do I support that, and then also just the whole thing of like dealing with, you know, so in both marriages, those ended, and you know, not in super nice ways. So having to go through that and maintain connection with these kids, and how do I? And I heard this counselor talking on the radio one time. He said the relationship skills that you need to support your kids after the relation, after, you know, after divorce kind of thing, those could have been the relationship skills that would have saved your marriage. So this is something else I want to say to any man who's listening is, no matter how difficult you're finding the situation now and how much you want to bail on things, your capacity to stay connected, even if you end up choosing to leave or if she leaves or whatever, your capacity to stay connected and to always remember that these kids, they're watching you, they're learning from you, and they need you to somehow, you know, maintain a heart connection, like a connection of integrity to this other parent. Otherwise, they suffer. And, you know, it's not always easy with the women who I've been married with to maintain that kind of thing, and I haven't always done it, but I know that that's kind of a piece of work that's, again, calling me out of my selfishness. I like what you said about the you know, the king archetype, you know. So it's not about my way or the highway, it's, how does my kingdom thrive? It's not just about me getting all the goodies. It's about how do I create a space where all of those who I'm responsible for in some way are doing well.
Yeah.
And that's a big thing. And most of us, yeah, you're right. Like, we're not taught how to do this. Most of us haven't had fathers or grandfathers who had these kind of skills. You know, I certainly didn't, you know, and you know, yeah, I certainly didn't. And most of the men that I know have. So again, this is why I think, you know, having children is a crucible, and but it's a way that we become better at who we are, I think. Even,
yeah, and I go ahead.
No, go on. It's your turn.
Well, I think I agree with what you were saying in terms of the other facet of that journey being the relationship with, you know, your partner through it all. And I think, I mean, frankly, I would say marriage and fatherhood together in some ways kind of create the most intense crucible, because they often are, you know, interplaying with one another. And, you know, my wife is, you know, I would say the most kind of profound mirror I have in many ways in terms of just where I am, and whether that's, you know, my emotional state or the ways that I'm in or not in integrity with my word. You know, but she often has a little bit more, I would say, compassion in terms of how the mirror is shown to me, as opposed to, like, you know, my daughter, she's 7, and you know, right now we're in the midst of a very intense chapter of parenting, where she's transitioning to a new school for first grade, and she keeps it together really well during the day at school, and then she comes home and she's a highly sensitive kid, and so she's just picking up on all of the energy, you know, of her classmates, her teacher, you know, everything going on. And then she gets home and she's picking up on, you know, my energetic state, my wife's, you know, energetic state, our emotional state, and, you know, wherever our son might be. And, you know, just having a really hard time regulating her emotions, her huge, huge feelings. And where, you know, we kind of, I feel like parenting kind of goes, you get these waves of intensity with it. And we're in the midst of probably the most intense wave we've had in terms of the emotional side of, you know, just getting triggered and having behaviors that just, you know, show me where, like, I'm still like, okay, my reaction to my daughter's emotionality is way out of proportion to what's happening in this moment. Can I find a little bit of space to disconnect with my own body or my breath in that moment, to just try and bring myself back to this moment, as opposed to this, you know, patterned response in my body that sends me into my reptilian brain, you know, whether it is to kind of go into the flight or fight response, like you were talking about in the opening, you know, breathwork practice. But, you know, and just kind of the whole family nervous system, if you will, you know, it's like one person starts to get dysregulated and how that can ripple through our family. So yeah, it's marriage and fatherhood together, both definitely the two most profound, I would say, awakeners for me in my life, period, to date.
Yeah, I would agree. It was something you said earlier, and I was going to, I think there's something, so, marriage as kind of like marriage, or, and I think there's a little bit of a difference. I'm a trained wedding celebrant, and marriage is like a really important topic for me. And I've been married a few times. and you know, that's not a, I'm not wearing that as a badge so much as like, I've been through the ringer. I put myself through a ringer, and other people, other, you know, other women and children through a ringer. And so I take this stuff really seriously. And I think in my experience, having children, some of the same stuff that I didn't want to deal with in my marriage and my relationship to this woman, I have to with my kids. I am more likely to want and expect the woman I'm with to kind of like, well, you know, you should be looking after your stuff too, you know, like, it's not like, I'll just do that kind of, well, maybe I don't do it anymore, but I certainly used to, like, you know, why do I have to be the one who like steps up to the plate here? Like, what are you doing kind of thing? Whereas I never expected that with my kids. With my kids, it was like, oh, you talked about, you know, like your 7-year-old daughter going through something. And if you would ask her to behave like an adult, it would just completely, well, maybe a couple of things. I mean, from my perspective, it's the biggest thing is it closes you off, or it closes me off to, this is something that David Data talks about, you know. So David Data is one of the teachers who I really respect. He talks about the feminine being the oracle in our lives. And that oracle, historically, if we look at the kind of stories about oracles, they weren't always like telling us pretty things, and they weren't always saying things in ways that made lots of sense or that were comprehensible to our particularly masculine way of logical way of looking at things. So I look at these kids, and particularly girls, who are particularly sensitive and particularly involved in an emotional life that most boys aren't, just how they are. And the stuff they go through is like, that's the sensitive kind of feelers of our nervous system. Like you said, did you say that? You know, the family is a nervous system, or like, you know, basically all of these people around me, they're all a little more sensitive than me, and they're giving me information, and lots of it isn't pretty, and lots of it isn't how I wish it would be. You know, lots of it isn't in that kind of bullet point form, you know, digested, action-oriented kind of thing. Most of it's just kind of like, whoa, like it's a flood of information that I'm not very good at processing. And if I didn't have it, my life wouldn't be as rich. So how do I, you know, there's another coach, Leroy Gordon, who I love talking to. And he said, basically our work is to receive. All the stuff that we do, you know, all the practices we do is just to prepare. And then there's the work of receiving. So if I look back at my family and my marriage, you know, in my marriage, I was reluctant to receive because I still had all kinds of stuff. But with my kids, it's really, I'm not going to expect the same kind of stuff from them. So I'm more likely to listen. And then I'm more likely to appreciate that the stuff that's coming at me, like I can either get, you know, into my defensive thing, or I can say thank you, you know, and I'm sorry for behaving. I had this wonderful, not so wonderful experience of I had gone to San Francisco and done a 3-day weekend intensive with John Weiland. Was quite had a huge impact on me. They were doing another one, a little more intense. The first one was called The Art of Intimacy or something like that. And the second was called The Art of Fearless Intimacy. And I was like, whoa, or fierce intimacy. Mm-hmm. So I went and did the second one in New York, and I came, and then I flew back into Vancouver, and immediately I started talking to one of my daughters, and almost immediately got into an argument with her, you know. And then I stepped back from that, like, wow, here I've been doing this intense weekend work of like being sensitized to, you know, how do I hold space, not deny myself, but hold space and listen to what the feminine in myself and others might be bringing me. And the first thing I do when I get home is I, you know, pick a fight with my daughter. It gets worse, you know. So that was like, okay, I'm sorry, you know, and I kind of backed off from that. And then I saw my other daughter, and I proceeded to do some of the same kind of stuff. And it was like, wow, like I am like so triggered around this stuff, and their feminine way of doing stuff that I'm just. But, you know, and if it would have been their mom, I would have gotten into a full-blown fight about it. But instead, I was like, whoa, here I am doing this thing. I know that I'm out of line. And so I was able to just, you know, own that, apologize, step back from it, and just look at, like, this is what I've been doing all my life. You know, whenever that stuff comes up that I don't particularly like, or that the information comes at me in a form I don't like it, I'll defend myself. So yeah, my marriages were definitely crucibles, and most of the time I wasn't able to step up to the plate as that king and kind of go, what's in the best interest here? Like, how do I hold the space? How do I hear? But as a dad, I'm much more able to do that. Now, I know men who struggle with that too, you know, and who are less able to do that. But I think that's what we're here to talk about, is to somehow with our kids, and especially if we've had marriages that have failed, and especially if we take our how we feel about our kids seriously. And there's very few men, even if they've gone through like horrible divorces. I don't know, actually, I don't know any man that I've met who has, you know, has completely cut himself off from his kids. There's still a desire to like somehow stay connected and to take some kind of responsibility there. So yeah, the Crucible, you know, definitely gets intense, especially when those two things are happening. And I think our kids are, and our relationship with our kids are, for me, have been a place where I'm more likely to respond in a healthy way.
Yeah, I mean, for me right now, my biggest edge is my relationship with my daughter and learning how to, you know, self-regulate in the face of her, you know, I mean, a really powerful ability to push my wife and my buttons in a way that has been helping us, you know, continue growing and waking up, but not getting ensnared there. Yeah, please.
So you use the word self-regulate. So let's take that apart and say, like, what do you actually have to do? So there's some guy listening to this right now who doesn't understand what this word means or what we're talking about. But your daughter comes home and she's really upset, and you start to feel upset yourself or just reactive to that. And then what do you do?
Sure. And I'm going to share all of this, and most of where I work with men and, you know, teach men, and the programs I offer is not from a place of supposed mastery. Here I'm up on my pedestal, but like, here's what is happening in the like gritty details of my day-to-day life, even actively now. And so, you know, if my daughter comes back home and she herself is kind of dysregulated, let's say just she's having, you know, outbursts, or she's, you know, physically like, you know, decided to like pick a fight with her brother, and it can be somewhat, you know, it's like cloaked in their play, but she'll all of a sudden, let's say, push him over, and it's kind of unclear like how intentional was it, you know, and we'll have to tell her you can't, you know, do those things. And a lot of times she just will then snap because she feels like we've somehow kind of judged her character, and then it might just kind of snowball from there when she gets really upset and worked up and is starting to, you know, either lash out at my wife or I. And so anyways, we're in a challenging patch there. In those moments, there will be times where, especially if she's ramped up her anger, you know, or is just saying things that are pushing those buttons for either my wife or I will find in myself that my level of anger all of a sudden is like catching me by surprise, where all of a sudden I've gotten kind of like anger came in the back door and it has taken over my brain and my body. And so I'll feel, you know, an intense level of anger in my, you know, in my system, and then like my breath will be tight, my chest, you know, my jaw will be clenched when I get to it. And so in those moments, if I have access to it, I will try and de-escalate my own system a little bit or diffuse it. And it's not going to pretend like I do it all the time. You know, but it might be just literally attuning to the tension in my body in that moment and just tracking like, where am I feeling really contracted right now? Or do I like, where is my breath in this moment? And then often for me, the most useful thing to do is try and slow and deepen my breath in those moments to help bring my whole system back down to the ground. And so it'll be breathing in, you know, as deeply and fully as I can and trying to do it. And if I'm able, you know, my wife and I are able to tag team a situation, then I might actually go out and step on the back porch or something like that. But you know, a lot of times it's not practical with another kid, and let's say needing to keep them separate in the moment where my daughter's having a hard time. And so it's just trying to stay tethered to my own physical, my body and my breath as much as I can, to just keep connected to that, so that I can keep kind of trying to ground, even if it's not completely regrounding, like getting back to like, I'm no longer angry at all, but just trying to stay present with that tendency in my system to get hijacked by the old emotional patterning of having this really powerful reaction when my dad would get angry. And I would go into this reptilian freak out mode of just like, oh shit, like dad's angry, like I'm not safe. And so like, even in my daughter's anger, I will, even though she's seven and she's not going to physically like be able to do much in terms of hurting me, there is a sense of like, I'm not safe in this moment, that overrides my, like my mental faculties in that moment. And so for me, trying to use the breath is probably the most powerful and consistent tool. It's just there right now, even if I can't physically get away. Sometimes it might be though, like going and standing in the backyard on the ground for a couple of minutes. I might take my son out there and just walk around. Sometimes it's using the punching bag in the garage that I've got just lying on the ground. And just, if I'm really dysregulated or feeling really angry, just, you know, using that and maybe screaming to just discharge some of that energy in a way that's not going to hurt anybody, then go back, you know, go back to engaging with my family. So it can look a number of different ways. I'm such a work in progress with this stuff, you know, but hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, that was great. And I, you know, I, like you, I mean, I feel like I'm a work in progress in this. I mean, I have the luxury of not, you know, my kids are, I now have grandkids. So I'm getting to watch my daughter and my son-in-law parent in a way that's like, it's amazing. And this is the kind, to anybody who's listening, I mean, this is the fruit of this work that we do, you know, I think, is that we get to see our kids just doing so much better at this. No matter how abysmally we struggle through some of this stuff, you know, like, and I made lots of mistakes with my kids. They're just doing things at a much better level. And I can see that this is based on stuff that I did with them. Like, I didn't do it perfectly, but they're taking it to another level. Mm-hmm. You know, my dad, I mentioned my, you know, my father as a poor example. I mean, he had a terrible upbringing. You know, he had an alcoholic, abusive father, and most of his siblings are pretty messed up. And I asked him one time, I said, "Dad, you know, like, your whole family's fucked up. You know, you're pretty fucked up, but you're not as fucked up as them. Like, what was the difference?" And he knew, like, because he left, you know, he emigrated when he was 18. He joined his brothers here in Canada, but within a short period of time, he was living with a neighboring family. They basically, you know, kind of took him in, and he got to see, he said, you know, like, that family and that man, that husband, you know, just showed me a different way of being a father and a husband. And you know, and my dad, you know, was not a great husband. He was, in lots of ways, you know, he was a problematic father, but he was so much better than his brothers and so much better than his father. And this, the woman who the husband and wife who he lived with, she was still alive, and I actually went and visited her once. And I mean, she knew me as from being a kid, but I went and visited her, and I said to her, you know, like, thank you. Like, it was, you know, they didn't make a conscious effort to, like, rescue my father or something. They just, you know, he basically knocked on their door and they let him in, and they showed him something different. And I said, thank you. Like, you made a huge difference in my life. And I didn't understand that at the time. So yeah, we're all just struggling. And then we see people who do things a little bit better, and we learn from them maybe. And, you know, I think that's, I'm going to be writing a piece on men's groups as part of a series I want to do on men's health, and like the value of sharing our stories, but also to have, I think this is the big one, you know, as examples, because there's very few examples. So we're like, we're just making it up as we go along. I said that when I was confronted with fatherhood, I had guys who were older than me who I had seen do things, but they weren't necessarily examples of how I wanted to be a father. And it felt like there was nothing out there. Like, there was one little book that I found, and it was kind of like a man's little journal on being a dad. And you know, it would have been really, really early stuff in the, I don't know. I can't even remember. This book might have been published in like the late 70s or early 80s. But there was nothing, you know, and that's how it felt to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we have, you know, a few more resources, but we still don't have like elders. We don't have, at least in this culture, we don't have, or and I mean like a kind of a white middle class North American culture. We don't, which is fragmented. I mean, you talk about moving across the country. So now you're with your wife's family. I'm assuming in California, perhaps you were closer to your family or something, or maybe not.
Yeah, we did. My folks and sister live in Colorado now, but they actually had been living in Northern Virginia prior to that point. So yeah, we didn't really have much in the way of family locally in California. So yeah, no support structure. There's a theme in there I'd love to touch on if that's
yeah.
all right.
Yeah.
I mean, I think just kind of around, you know, what are the examples, or whether they're positive or negative, that we had, you know, experience with as men or as boys prior to becoming fathers ourselves, you know. And my dad did a lot of things really well as a father in terms of, I would say, carrying that baton from his parents and advancing it. My dad was a very affectionate father. Like, I had a lot of, you know, physical play that was, you know, very warm-hearted and loving, you know, and in some ways I kind of derived more affection as I got to be a larger kid from my dad and from playing with him than I got from my mother. You know, kind of physical touch, I think, became less comfortable from her after I went from being a really small child. You know, and then there was my dad's anger and his, you know, tendency to bottle up all of his rage until he would just, you know, lose it and unload on us. And that was terrifying for me. And so many of my early childhood memories are of his getting really dysregulated and losing it with his anger. And for me as a father, you know, kind of early on in the father journey, it was very clear. It's like, I wanted to move the needle on that front in particular. I wanted to be nothing like my father when it came to how he dealt with his anger. And it took becoming a dad to then realize that the apple had not rolled very far from the tree, or at least as far as I would have hoped when it came to my own anger, and realizing that, like, wow, I have a lot of the same tendencies to bottle it all up and think that I'm able to like keep it under control. And my kids are both so sensitive and perceptive that they, like, even if my wife or I completely mask how we are feeling in terms of our external presentation, they're both just so attuned to where we are that they immediately sense that we're angry or we're upset. And a lot of times they'll name it. And so, you know, with that, I think has been this, frankly, kind of this mourning process my wife and I have gone through of having to reconcile with this lofty vision we established for ourselves, you know, prior to becoming parents or in the early days of how we wanted to show up and how that would be different from the ways that we felt, less supported by our parents' parenting, and to, you know, dramatically move the needle, and then realizing like, oh, like, wow, here I am, like in the thick of it under all of the pressure of that crucible, repeating that same stuff. And it's mm-hmm. in that moment though of making those mistakes, that's where I feel it really matters. Like, can I choose differently? Can I now do the work when I am brought to my knees and I'm like, all of these old beliefs or ways of processing my emotions or not processing them or not looking at these things is now starting to rear their ugly head. Now, can I do the work? And I think it's in those moments of, like, for me, it's a big edge is to forgive myself for those mistakes as a father that I had like sworn to myself I wasn't going to repeat, you know, and making them, and then having to not go down the path of flagellating myself for those mistakes and, you know, kind of beating myself up, which only kind of further keeps them entrenched, and instead trying to learn how to forgive myself for those mistakes. And then from that point, start doing the work. Like, how can I show up differently? You know, what do I need to do to not get to that same boiling point with my own anger? Like, why is that happening? Well, like, I have this belief that I'm not worthy of taking care of myself or meeting my own needs as fully as I probably should. So I'll, you know, keep giving as a dad, keep self-sacrificing. But at some point, like, it's coming from a place of resentment. It's not coming from a place of pure giving. And I think as parents, whatever form it takes, we end up making those mistakes that we kind of swore or desired we would never make ourselves. And there's that's to me, like, that's where some of the real journey starts, is now, can I move the needle? Can I honor my whole humanness, the messiness of how I'm going to show up as a parent, and teach my kids how to be a messy but loving and a human who has integrity and is willing, like, or able to do the hard work at that point.
Yeah. And on top of that, we're, most of us are trying to do a better job as husbands too.
And yes.
So there's lots going on, and there's lots of reasons to feel shitty. and I think you're right. Like, you know, do you know Stephen Jenkinson? Do you know his work at all?
No.
He's a guy who has interesting things to say, and he has this interesting thing to say about regret. He basically doesn't have any patience for this culture of no regrets, or I did the best that I could, whatever. He's basically saying, if you did the best that you could, then we're in a really sad place. That we actually need to feel our regret to fuel what you're talking about, you know? So it's not about acknowledging a regret is not about self-flagellation. It's about, this is the place where I make a choice, a different choice. So that's the first thing, is like, I hear lots of, and I see lots of this, you know, in this particular kind of macho culture of, like, no regrets, you know, just keep moving on, you know. And I want to say, and again, I've, you know, this is a lovely Stephen Jenkinson idea. But he says, when you were a kid, your mother made you sit down and eat your lunch. She was breaking your momentum so that you actually slowed down. I mean, consciously, she's not doing that. Well, maybe she was. Maybe you're, like, you know, bouncing off the wall, and it's like, just sit down and eat your fucking lunch, you know? But his thing is, like, to break the momentum, because, and particularly I know in my own life, and, you know, and I can see this as something that I, you know, my father was really good at that. Like, he'd get going on things and he'd get busy and he'd do all kinds of stuff. And so much of what I'm trying to learn to do is less, you know, like, the less I do, the more room there is for the world to come to me and for me to receive it, whether it's my upset preteen daughter. So your daughter at 7 is just starting to show you what's going to happen for lots of girls when they're, you know, 11, 12, 13. And frankly, it's a wild ride, you know, and it was for me. And I remember running into a teacher who, she had taught my kids, and she was saying something about, yeah, you know, it's a really interesting, it's a love. She actually looked at it with appreciation at this time, you know, like, these girls just really feeling their power and their capacity. And none of it, like, there's no regulation, you know, it's just, and the only regulation is basically what the kind of structure I gave them, you know, like, no, you can't wear those clothes. No, you can't wear that makeup. You know, like, basically a lot of no's, but then also trying to find the yeses, and having an appreciation that for lots of women, you know, like, this moment of being totally alive and totally, like, crazy in lots of ways could be seen as a really beautiful time. So how do I make that safe? You know, I would say to my oldest daughter a bit later, you know, things had kind of quieted down, but So she, you know, very quickly gave her a cell phone. This was like way early, right? I mean, her first time I gave her a cell phone, she was carrying a brick around, you know. But it was like I'd call her, you know, or she'd call me. You know, the deal was that she called me at midnight on Fridays or something like that. You know, she was living with her mom, but I was living in closer to town where she was usually doing her party and stuff. And, you know, she'd call me up and just check in, like, so that I knew what was happening. You know, and then the next day, you know, I'd come and pick her up and take her to her job, you know, and just, I said to her, you know, your job is to push the envelope. I get that. Like, this is what you need to be doing. My job is to make sure you got a safety net around you so that you can fall, but you don't hurt yourself too bad, you know? And she was a risk taker. Well, she was somebody who really pushed the edges, but she also had, from a really early age, and I watch this now with her daughter, takes risks, but is very aware of what she's doing. You know, she'll hurt herself, but not super bad. And that always felt like really good to me, was that I gave her enough room to like have some falls, but not really serious ones.
Mm.
I don't know.
That's a great. I really like how you summarize that in terms of the contrasting, you know, energies there, right? Her desire to expand and to be out there living fully, exploring, taking risks, etc., and then the role of the father to keep her safe, but without restraining her freedom to some degree, that she doesn't get to fully develop or live that expression that is inherently inside of her being in that time. I mean, yeah, we're already starting to bump on that with, you know, our daughter feeling like, you know, she's 7, but going on, you know, 12 or 13 years old right now. So,
yeah. Well, and it's interesting because I think all the stuff that we do when they're little, you know, so they learn how to, measure risks by being on a climbing wall or walking a balance beam or riding a bicycle. I mean, there's all kinds of ways that they just start to figure out who they are and how do they deal with, you know, the scary and the exciting and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, I wasn't consciously thinking, well, that's not true. I mean, in some ways I was consciously thinking about, you know, I want this child to be at the edge, like to be comfort or to be willing to go to an edge and not afraid of that. Like that to me seemed to be like a really good thing. So even at an early age, like her mother would freak out because I would let her balance on things that to her mom felt like risky things. But again, I was always sure that there was a little risk that she would, you know, stumble and scrape her knee or something like that, but she wasn't going to go tumbling down the mountainside or something.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, you know, those are judgment calls. I mean, I made a different kind of judgment call than her mom would have made, but that was all about, you know, how do I create this space for her to explore her edges so that when she gets to being, you know, I had a neighbor when my kids were growing up, and he had a couple of daughters, and he said, so our daughters were similar age and they were at the point of starting to take a little more risks, you know, going to little music festivals in town and stuff like that, you know. And he said, well, you know, by this point, if they haven't learned how to, you know, make some good decisions, like it's too late. You know, so it's like all the stuff that we did with them by, you know, taking them camping and putting them in Cub Scouts and all the stuff that we did. And, you know, that's all in little ways helps them learn who they are and helps them make decisions about what kind of environments they choose to be in. And then the values that we have, I mean, the, you know, the relationship you have with your wife and how you communicate with her, even the kind of troubled stuff that happened with me and my first wife, you know, like there were some value stuff that my daughters learned that, know, that helped them get through all kinds of stuff, even when I was not capable of being there, or, you know, was not in good shape sometimes. They had a kind of wisdom that they had learned from the kind of environment they were in. So we make, you know, I think we're all just a work in progress. You know, like I said, I watch my daughter and my son-in-law doing, like, the way they're parenting just blows me away. Like, it's, and I have a friend who's got kids and grandkids, and he says the same thing. You know, he watches his son and daughter-in-law parenting in a way that he just is so in so much admiration. And it wasn't how he wasn't how I mean, he might have aspired to that, but, you know, from a developmental point of view, he was not there, you know? And apparently his son is, you know, and apparently my daughter is. So yeah, they surprise us. And I guess that's one of the things I want to say to you, but also to any, you know, men who are parenting right now, is our kids will surprise us. And, you know, you said this thing about, like, looking after ourselves, like, they will see how we look after ourselves, and that will factor into how they look after themselves. And I struggled with that. I didn't know how to do that. I also wanted to comment on, you know, in this culture, we have a poor opinion of sacrifice, but that's what our significant relationships, they call for some level of sacrifice. You know, I can't be the man I was when I was 27, you know, when I found out that my wife was pregnant. I can't be that man. I had to sacrifice those things. And that was a good sacrifice. It was hard. I didn't like it. It wasn't comfortable. But I'm, you know, my life is so much better for having made that sacrifice. It's the same with the relationship I'm in now. You know, it's recognizing that there's times when it's good to make sacrifice. It's always scary, but it's good.
That's well said. I think we learned we were going to be fathers at the same age. I was 27 when we found out my wife was pregnant with our daughter. And when I look back to who I was then to compared to where I am now, I'm so glad I'm not that man any longer. you know, and I'm so grateful to have had this opportunity to have been forced to grow and evolve as a man, as I have over the last 7-8 years, because of that journey of fatherhood. And so well said, it's not been comfortable at all. I mean, I'm glad I don't have to walk those 8 years again, frankly. But I would never have, if I could go back and choose again, I would never choose to not take the fatherhood path.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, most birthdays, most of my oldest daughter's birthdays, I make some comment about, like, you know, you're like, here, this is the best thing that ever happened to me, you know, like, and I love the relationship I have with all of my kids, you know, it's very, and there's always some kind of challenge, different. So my oldest stepson, so my kids this year are 36, 35, 34, and 28, I think. And with my oldest stepson, it's been a very different kind of experience with him. He's a very gentle, very quiet, very reserved man. And I have to, with my girls and with my youngest stepson, it's a very verbal, like, there's a lot of verbal activity and a lot of mental verbal activity. But with my oldest son, I just have to be really patient. I have to just really slow myself down. and let him kind of step into things the way that works for him. You know, they're all so different, these kids. I feel really lucky that I have, you know, I had a great experience with raising daughters, and then I, with my second marriage, I got these boys, and it was totally different. You know, I mean, they're totally different families, totally different histories. You know, but and both of the boys remind me of, they're very, very different, but they both remind me of myself in different ways, and I trigger around that. Not so much with the oldest, because most of how I identify with him is a really positive. It's part of myself that I really like. But with my youngest son, it's a lot of the stuff that just feels like, oh my God, I wish I, you know, I wish that wasn't there.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, with our daughter, you know, she's gone through a tendency lately of victimizing herself to her circumstances or her situation, and we have to do the hard look in the mirror and be like, well, where did she get that from? You know, why is she doing that? Who's shown her that? You know, and so my wife and I certainly have a, you know, tendency at times, like the knee-jerk reaction is to somehow paint ourselves as the victim, at least in our head, or the story we're telling ourselves in a situation. And have to just accept, right, what the mirror is reflecting back in terms of, you know, the things that we do well and the things that we unconsciously are passing on that we don't intend to or would prefer not to.
Yeah, it never ends, you know. Like I said, my kids are adults now and having children of their own, a couple of them, or one of them. And it's really interesting to watch myself being a grandfather, but and seeing like my granddaughters, and particularly the older one who just turned 3, and her, in a similar way as her mother, you know, wanting to push edges and having a lot of capacity, and it's been really exciting to watch that. And then also feeling a little afraid for her. You know, I think this is the other thing about being dads who are, well, I think dads have always been very protective of particularly the girls or daughters. So that's a generalization, but there's lots of that. And now we have to be a little protective of feeling that about our sons, because culturally our sons are not being raised to thrive in this environment where a lot of our old skills, particularly like our defensive skills, our ability to protect and fight and that kind of thing, are not so appropriate. But that's still happening for them. You know, they're still reacting that way. And our daughters are like, yeah, there's lots of really good stuff happening for girls, and there's lots of hard stuff happening for them. And I think for our boys, it's how do we support them to be men in a place that doesn't, we don't have, I don't think we have good paths for the masculine yet, or they're not very well laid out. The culture is still struggling. It's actually one of the things that have you seen the Barbie movie?
Yeah.
So I love the Barbie movie. And I think there's lots of really good, it's, you know, it's humorous, and it's got lots of stuff that shouldn't be taken too seriously. And it's got some stuff that I think can be taken very seriously. I think the part at the, for me, the way it ends, where she basically lays out what's confronting a lot of the culture, which is that women don't really need us men, not the way they used to a generation ago or two generations ago. So we can step back a little bit from all the things that we think we're good at or the thing that we're needed for and kind of go, well, what am I actually good at? And what is it that I actually want to do? You know, that's Barbie's, you know, challenge or request of Ken at the end of it is like, go figure yourself out, you know?
Yep.
I'm trying to figure myself out. And I've got like two generations of women who've been leading this stuff, you know, trying to figure out how we are. It's time for you guys to start doing this, and making the Mojo Dojo cat man cave is not the answer. You know, what's it going to be?
Yeah. The Ken Casa house. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a really great point. And something that I really struggled with personally, I kind of rejected my own masculinity, or that I just, you know, my dad, you know, with the anger and just some of the ways that he modeled, you know, showing up in a relationship with my mother, you know, there's a lot of things I was like, I don't want to repeat that, or I didn't like those, you know, pieces that are kind of, you know, based in patriarchy and things, you know, along those lines that I just didn't feel were healthy. And so kind of in my early adulthood, late teens and early adulthood, I kind of distanced myself from my own masculinity in a way where I had not seen modeled a conscious form of masculinity. And I had only seen the negative forms of it, you know, many of them, you know, kind of the shadow sides, right, of different, you know, masculine archetypes. And it wasn't until really becoming a father that I started to see, like, wow, there's actually this huge need for healthy, conscious masculinity, that this role is so necessary. And I think in my relationship with my wife, having children, I mean, really created a new level of polarity in our marriage, where, you know, my wife was very independent and, you know, entrepreneur, and had started her own nonprofit that had grown considerably in the San Francisco Bay Area, and, you know, running a team of people that delivered yoga and mindfulness education to the public school system. And so she went from having, you know, this very, a very independent life to then, you know, a few years after my daughter was born, deciding to leave those things behind, and, you know, have me be the sole breadwinner. And so this level of dependency, and then also just the need for me to step up and provide, I would say, masculine leadership and show up from that king energy, like we were talking about at the beginning, of this form of courageous and selfless service, you know, of being able to provide vision and discernment about what's necessary, do what's hard, do not necessarily what's in the interest of my own kind of desires at the point in time, but what the kingdom, my family needs. And I think fatherhood has forced me to kind of come back to my own masculinity and to find a conscious form of masculinity, and to do a lot of work that has been, that's required a lot of courage to step into my own form of kingship, if you will, in terms of how I show up as a father. And a lot of the work that I do with men is around trying to use, in many ways, that all of the challenges that come about with fatherhood and with marriage as these opportunities, instead, to step into a healthy and conscious form of masculinity. I run a 10-week program online for men called The New King, where essentially it's like an invitation to step into a healthy expression of the king archetype within your own life, and to really kind of move into and evolve into that conscious form of masculinity as men. And for a lot of men, it's something that, like, there's very little, like, they innately understand that what healthy masculine leadership might look like, or what healthy masculinity is, but they don't have examples that they can pull from very easily. And, you know, our fathers often didn't provide that to us. And maybe we got lucky and we saw some of it. Maybe our father showed some piece of it, but they didn't provide the full spectrum of what that looks like. But I think our culture is just so dearly lacking right now the kind of those examples for us to pull from in our own kind of embodied memory, and then step into that, you know, when the time comes to be a husband, or to be a father, or to be even a leader in our community, and to lead from that place of healthy, conscious, you know, let's say king energy or masculine leadership, as opposed to abdicating responsibility or abusing it, abusing power. So yeah, I don't have any easy solutions other than like us men have a lot of work cut out for ourselves in terms of doing this. And it starts with the work we do on ourselves and the work we do with our sons too.
And our nephews and our cousins and our younger brothers and our younger friends and our older friends, and the kid, the boy down the street. Like those of us who, for either by choice or whatever, end up being, you know, fathers. There's, like I said earlier, there's lots of guys who are choosing not to be biological fathers. But there's a lot of boys out there who need our, and girls, who need what we have to offer. If we're in any way kind of thinking about this stuff, you know, I just encourage men to like get involved with Boys and Girls Club, you know, get involved with Big Brothers, find ways to mentor, find ways to coach sports, you know, find ways to engage with younger men, because you may not want to have a child of your own, but you've got something, and that something is just your willingness to look at what it means to be a man. And I, you know, like you, you know, by the time I was in my early teens and late teens and early 20s, I was a reluctant man, I guess. I mean, you know, I liked having sex with women, you know, I definitely identified as a heterosexual masculine being, but that was really the only thing that really, you know, came to me and, you know, in a comfortable way. The rest of it just seems like I don't see good models, you know, I don't everything stinks, everything sucks, and so how do I do this? And so I really wasn't I struggled as a, particularly as a husband, but having kids, yeah, like you pulled me into roles and ways of being and that were really gratifying. So for, you know, if you're listening to this and you don't identify as a dad, that's fine. But there's a boy out there, a young man, who can benefit from your awareness and your commitment to being a better man. And it's through that relationship that you will actually find out how to be a better man. I think that's the, you know, but I know for me that having my own children and then taking on stepkids as, you know, my responsibility, that was hugely transformative. But that's not the only way. It just happens to be the easy way in some ways.
Yeah, that's really well said. And yeah, there is just this huge community level need for men to, you know, pull other men and boys under their wing in a nurturing, you know, but genuine kind of capacity around helping them move into that. And it's made, I feel like, in some ways challenging by just how much our culture has also just wanted to depolarize, you know, kind of the differences between, you know, masculine and feminine, whether or not it's necessarily assigned to someone of a certain gender. And I think that makes it even more challenging for boys today to discern, like, what is healthy, like, what's a healthy expression of masculinity? Because there's just so much media right now that's showing, essentially, like, shaming men for many of their kind of, you know, base level desires that they've acted on. And there's not a lot of representation in our culture of what healthy masculinity looks like right now.
Yeah, and that's on us, you know. So yeah. That's where we step up, you know. And that's not always comfortable. I stepped up in a place and talked about some things, and just caught a lot of flack for it recently. And you know, part of my response was like, "Oh, I don't want that. I'm going to back off." But maybe that's just the price we pay. You know, it's like, just to do that, to try to find ways of being in integrity as we express being the men that we are as best as we can. And for me, it's also this constant feedback loop of like, oh, you know, sometimes I need to adjust my behavior or my words or what I'm doing. And sometimes that's just how it is. You know, it's just going to be painful and some people are not going to be happy. I think that's the other thing about being a dad is that there's just lots of me learning that sometimes people are not going to be happy. You know, especially when they're teenagers, you know, saying no, drawing lines, and they're really good at like just slipping out and, or, you know, doing an end run and, you know, and then just like having patience with the whole process, with myself, with the kids, as best as I can. And, you know, we're all just making it up. You know, we're all just inventing something.
Yes.
And so there's going to be lots of mistakes and lots of discomfort, and that's okay. We're almost at time. Do you have a short practice for fatherhood or facing the challenges of fatherhood?
Sure. Yeah, I'll share a practice I offer men in the 10-week online program that I mentioned. And it's, you know, it's not necessarily specific for men, but I think it's really useful for men because it's something that we're often not very, you know, just aware of, which is our kind of emotional state, right? And so it's a feelings and needs check-in that I have men do multiple times a day through this program early on, and we carry that practice forward through that 10 weeks. And essentially, it's just, you know, very simple, but I guess I'll preface it a little bit with, especially I think for boys, we are, you know, conditioned through our childhood to not exhibit negative emotions, you know, or if we are feeling a negative emotion, to not really express it, whether it's anger, whether it's grief, whether it's you know, jealousy, or it's you know, any form of kind of, I would say, negative charge that ultimately ends up being triggering for a parent or a care provider of some form or teacher around us. And so I think a lot of men end up hiding those negative emotions that they had as boys, and they continue to do that to the point that for most of us as men, some of this stuff just is operating in shadow. It's completely out of our consciousness. And so we're not even able to answer the question, like, how am I feeling right now? It's just kind of, many men will draw blank when we start doing this practice. And so the practice is just simply just asking myself, you know, how am I feeling right now? And to name it. And I'll often give men a list of feelings, and it can be both, you know, emotional kind of based feelings, or it can be even just physical sensations, if that's a more accessible place to start. And so it's saying, like, you know, I'm feeling, let's just say, I'm feeling angry right now. And the next piece of it is to say, feeling angry is a right way to feel. And so it's validating the emotion after acknowledging what it is that we're feeling. Because a lot of times any negative emotional state that we had was never validated. It was like, you know, like, you stop crying, it's okay. Like, you're, you know, your mom will be back soon. Or, you know, like stop being angry, stop hitting your brother right now. Just a lot of these things were just kind of pushed. And so it's not to say that it's a good thing to act on, but the fact that you have that felt experience in your body or your system, like, that is a right way to feel. Because there's something, a lot of times I think men are disconnected from the fact that their emotions are giving them real-time feedback about what is working well in their lives and what needs to change. Our emotions are giving us that real-time feedback a lot of times. So, you know, going through that example, you know, how am I feeling? I'm feeling angry. Feeling angry is the right way to feel. And then the next thing is, you know, what do I need right now? And not to do for someone else, but what do I need in this moment right now? So it might be, I need to go step on the back porch and take 5 deep breaths. And sometimes we can't actually meet the need that emerges from us when we ask that question, but it's just building that in. It literally is a practice that can be done in, you know, 15, 20 seconds. You know, I'll tell men, like, you can start by just like putting a sticky note, like above the toilet somewhere, like, and you just, a place that you go to the bathroom, you know, several times a day, and you can just start seeing it, and you just use that as a time to tune to it. But, you know, just repetitions is where this really goes, as is a dedication to actually wanting to find out what the answers are to those two questions, and then having that validating statement. So anyways, yeah, just asking yourself, how are you feeling? Saying, you know, I feel, you know, this way, that feeling is the right way to feel. What do I need? You know, I need to go out in the back porch for, you know, a couple of minutes to cool down. You know, simple, very simple practice. I mean, it sounds kind of so basic, and a lot of men at first are just kind of like, really, what? Like, we're like, this is what I'm learning in this program. But the change happens when men go from just being very disconnected and unable to name how they're feeling to having real-time access to that, that then informs how they're able to show up, where they're recognizing their emotional state and then using that as input in the moment to guide how they show up in conflict, or how they show up in a difficult conversation, or how they show up, you know, like when they have maybe had a pattern of neglecting their own needs or not acting on them. So a little simple thing, but thought that some of your listeners might appreciate it. It's just really one of these things where if you bring genuine energy to it and you repeat it, you know, I have the men do it 5 times a day or more. It's really powerful.
How am I feeling? It's good to feel that, or it's okay to feel that.
All right. It's feeling, you know, let's say feeling angry is a right way to feel. And
how am I feeling? Feeling this way is the right way to feel. What do I need? And
sorry to correct you, but I would say is a right way to feel as opposed to the.
Ah, okay.
Yep.
How am I feeling? Feeling this way is a right way to feel. What do I need right now?
Yep, that's it.
Okay.
And I'm very particular about that language, because I think, and I've gotten pushback from men just like, well, like, what if like feeling angry isn't the right way to feel? It's like, well, it's a right way to feel in response to what's happening. Doesn't mean that like living your life from a place of anger is the right thing to do, but you can't stop yourself in that very moment from feeling angry. You choose whether or not you feed that wolf, right? But
right. Yeah. And it goes back to the, as you said, our emotions are telling us something, or information about how we are in the world.
Yes.
And we pay a price when we don't pay attention to information.
Big price.
A big price, big, yeah. Price. Thank you very much for joining me today, Jay.
Thanks for having me, Hans.
Yeah. And let's do this again sometime. I mean, the topic of fatherhood, well, you'll experience that as you go through that. And I am, even as my kids are adults, it never ends. It's always beautiful stuff to learn. Sometimes it's hard. It's always rich.
Yes.
Okay. Mm. Take care. And anybody who's listening to this, if you've got questions for Jay, you can, Jay, what's your website?
Yeah, it's awakened-masculine.com.
Awakened-masculine.com. That's where you'll find him. You'll find me at sacredbodies.ca. You can send either one of us a message. And I'll be posting this to the podcast soon. And I'll let you know as soon as I do. Okay. Take care.
Thanks, Hans. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.